Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
You've reached the Murder Between Friends podcast with Sherilyn Dale and Gavin Fish. Please stay on the line. This week's episode starts in 3, 2, 1.
Gavin, you are my new co-host.
Here I am. I'm honored.
I'm so pumped. I'm honored that you are here. I think we've got some like really fun stuff for everybody to watch. Very much in the opposite attracts, you know, category. Yet we're still very similar because, you know, I watch all the true crime shows for us. You do not. I have
that is
more
true.
Dateline saved than my PBR can handle. I drink for the two of us.
Yeah.
You do
no,
not.
But we just clicked when we got together in Minnesota looking at the David Elmquist case. We just clicked. And it's really funny to look at the photos that were taken of us. We're completely opposite people, but we've got the same goals when it comes to solving crimes, don't we?
Amen. And I think, that's definitely what attracted me to this partnership. And yeah, like you said, it was just like instant connection that, you know, that chemistry is there. And at the end of the day, our end goal is exactly the same and all of that matters. So I am so excited to see, you know, where this adventure takes us. I'm so honored to have you here.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
In me and the podcast, of course. That being said, we're not messing around. We have already pre-filmed our first episode, and it was a gooder. We were honored to have some pretty big names, two huge victim and survivor advocates, Tara Newell and Collier Landry, on. And I mean, if this episode is just a taste of what's to come, like, I can't wait.
Yeah, these guys are amazing. They're terrific advocates for victims of violent crime because they have been there themselves. So yeah, it's a great episode.
Amen. Without further ado, you guys, here is our first episode back with Murder Between Friends with Gavin Fish and Sherilyn Dale and our special guests, Tara Newell and Collier Landry. What I recently spoke with, I don't know if you know of Stacey Peterson. She was married to Drew Peterson, and her body is still not found. He was a cop and had already killed another wife of his, and she knew about it, and all of a sudden she went missing. And anyways, there was a Lifetime movie done there. Like, Rob Lowe played him and Kaylee Cuoco. And so I think, like, right now, her sister is still actually trying to find her. And she doesn't have the resources to get the sonar dive equipment that she needs. Okay. Because she's in the ocean or in a, what would you call it?
Deep body of water.
Yeah, like, it's like a
submerged body of water.
Yeah, like, yeah, it's not like so she kind of knows where she is but doesn't have the resources. And so in my mind, I'm like, okay, well, they've done like a Lifetime movie. What happens at that point, you know, when they approach you to do a Lifetime movie of your life, your family? Do you sign over these rights and now you have no, you know, like, nothing to it? Or do they help with, like, the victims' families going forward? I'm very curious about it.
So I was lucky in a sense of, like, that I was involved.
Okay.
Because I'm finding out that a lot of victims and survivors aren't involved in a lot of their stories.
Right.
So I was lucky in that sense. However, I deserve more money than I got compensated for. You know, it's a scripted series. And then, like, the podcast, I never got any money for that. I just got money for the scripted series and the documentary with Oxygen that got made. Wow. And then I'm finding out that it's really, like, with talking to other true crime survivors, that there's, like, really a hit or miss. Some people get, like, a good dollar amount. Some people get, like, a mid-dollar amount. Some people get, like, low dollar amount. And some people get nothing.
Wow.
So it's really, like, all ends of the spectrum. And I was somewhere, like, kind of in the middle, we'll say. And there's a lot of people, like, the Jeffrey Dahmer series and, you know, Ryan Murphy, that's his name.
Yeah.
Ryan Murphy, he's not getting consent of the victims and the families that have been traumatized by this real trauma. And to other people, and, you know, I worked in the media. I've done background. I've done stand-in positions. I thought it would be fun to be an actor at one point. Never, like, did that acting, you know? Mm-hmm. But I worked in the industry, and my ex was a PA and did stuff with cameras and whatnot. And I've been in the industry now, but it's crazy that, like, when you see the media and everything, you're so, like, you're so shocked and you're so, like, glamorized. This, like, thing is so glamorized in a sense.
Yeah.
And so you're just looking at
Do you mean the,
like,
finished product?
Wow. Well, like,
do you mean the finished product when you look at the actual show?
Like, when you look at any series, you know, it's glamorized. It's,
yeah, like, when you're watching, they make the story as a whole, like, this, like you say, Gavin, murder porn. And people are, like, desensitized to it because it's become this non-reality almost.
You know, where, like, the O.J. Simpson story is cool, in a sense. And I, you know, a lot of people think differently about that, for sure, but there are the people that are like, oh, wow, he got away with murder. That's crazy. And there are people that are legit upset about it, like the sister, you know, Nicole's sister. And, you know, there's real people involved. Yeah. And Collier works in the industry. So, you know, he even knows a lot more about this, too, because he's worked in it for a long time. He's a DP, and he, like, told his story after the fact that he's worked in the industry for a while.
Right. I saw your documentary. It was so beautiful. I had a question about it when you were putting it together and watching, like, Little Collier. Did you just want to put you in your pocket? Like, how was that to, like, differentiate from, like, who you are today to watching you on the stand then?
So what I would say was probably the most interesting thing for me was, so I'm sitting in the theater in New York on our, when we first, for our world premiere, like U.S. world premiere. And I'm watching this kid on the witness stand going, huh, why is, like, this kid, like, this is me. Like, this is still me. I'm just a little bit older. I'm the same snarky, sarcastic, my same snarky, sarcastic self. I mean, there's so much of this. And I was just like, oh my God, that's so funny. So that's what it was for me.
Okay, I love it. So I guess what I'd really like to do, and I think this is going to help Gavin as well, because Collier, before you got on, Gavin was just kind of letting Tara know that true crime is definitely not his wheelhouse in, like, the traditional sense of somebody having, like, any interest in it. He really wants to solve, you know, as many cases as he can and advocate for families and survivors and stuff like that. So it's definitely, you know, the same vibe that you guys have and where I want to be in terms of helping victims. But so for somebody like Gavin, who would not be, you know, on top of all of the true crime stories, whoever wants to start, I want to know from both of you, but can you guys kind of give us a little insight of, like, why you guys are here, you know, in your position in life right now? What brought you here?
Sure.
Why don't we start with Collier, since your story was first?
Well, it's interesting because I think this is very common for both Tara and myself, which is, you know, we didn't ask to be a part of this. Like, we didn't ask to be a subject of a true crime series, right? We got sort of forced into this situation. And I think that for me, it was this sort of, I needed to do something with my story. I needed to do something with my mother's story. I needed to honor her because I wouldn't say obsessed, but I was, I guess maybe obsessed, not obsessed, but I was very sensitive to the fact that after what happened to my mother, after what happened to me, that I saw how people reacted to the consumption of the case, whether it be in my own town, whether it be people I would meet in the state of Ohio when I would travel, whatever it was. And that was, you know, everybody is very immersed in the drama of the bad guy, the crime, the perpetrator, the crime, you know, what happened to the victim. And there's this weird sort of thing that seemed to shift where as soon as the gavel hit and we said next, right, that it ended up being this whole other, just it was like out of sight, out of mind. And we never really examined the consequences of violence. We never examined how when we were, you know, it just essentially just stopped right with that, right? You know, we were fascinated up until a certain point. Then the gavel hits. It's like the bad guy goes to jail. The state gets its restitution. The gavel hits and we say next. And we don't ever examine the consequences of violence on family, not only on families and victims, right? But the ancillary victims, like the people who were like the best friend of the victim, the kids' schoolmates at class at school when this happened, the community as a whole, the prosecutor, their family, the police department, the detectives, that we don't look at the ramification on the community, the ripple effects of violence. And that is only, in my opinion, become something that has been sort of the moment, fashionable, whatever you want to call it, apropos, recently. Like, I would say in the last, like, 10 years, we've become really like, oh, what happened? What are the real, you know, and now everybody's, and I wouldn't call it, like, wokeism or anything like that, but I would call it, like, oh, everybody's, like, now we're hyper aware that, oh, these bad things have consequences that are far reaching outside of the scope of just the crime, the bad guy, the victim. You know what I mean? Because we're seeing these ripple effects and how it affects communities. Like, and you can take that, you know, into recent things like the Las Vegas shooting, right? And how that impacted a community there. You can look at you know, the murder of Michael Brown, right? And the community of Ferguson, right? And the rise of ultimately the Black Lives Matter movement. The wake of the victims of Harvey Weinstein, just to use things that are off of topic, right? You know, top of mind for us recently, right? Unfortunately, you know, you have, you know, Jeffrey Epstein, and then the recent conviction of Ghislaine Maxwell, and in these things, like, oh, we're really aware of those, and so now we're looking at those, like, oh, so this is what happened to the victims of being sex trafficked, for example. This is what happened to the family, you know, of an activist's, you know, an activist's son was lynched in a tree, for example, right? You know, all these things that are far reaching into communities and that contribute to, I wouldn't say an error of distrust, but I would say that when we now talk about, and this is just a jump ahead, but when you talk about ethical true crime, you have these things where people are examining these stories and they're not looking at the full scope of them. And then that ultimately affects people because it plays upon their distrust of the personal, whether it be the system that they're involved in or whatnot. And then you look at that, those ramifications then leading into things like incarceration reform, right? Prison reform. Like, I was on an interview earlier today with an inmate who has been convicted rightfully of murder since he was the age of 17. So even discussing like how those things impact communities that lead to people to have, if you don't have a proclivity towards violence, you would gravitate towards it because there's nothing else, right? Or you get involved in the wrong situation. That's really wild long-winded that you're answer. Saying this because
Gavin
really
just did
answer.
This today too. No, I love that. Yeah. Gavin literally just had this same day as you, and we just had this conversation about, you know, like systematic justice and situations. That's wild.
Colliers, how old were you when it all happened?
Yeah, so I was 11 years old when it happened, when I witnessed the murder happen, and I was 12 when it went to trial when I testified.
So I remember, like, when I was in sixth grade, I had a classmate whose mom died, like, expectedly. She was ill, right? But the effects that that had on him, actually, you know, I remember he beat up a teacher at our school because he wanted to leave, and the teacher Oh. didn't want him to leave. He just needed to leave, right? And then sure. here I am, however many years later, 35 years later, that still affects me. The whole idea that you have to allow somebody who is grieving to grieve. Right. So everything that you're saying right there is like, I completely identify with it. My question to you is when you're in fifth and sixth grade and you're dealing with the murder of your mom, you know, what does that look like in your daily life? You still had to go to school, right? You still had to live. What did that look like?
Well, I mean, the first part of that was when, you know, the 25 plus days of when my mother was missing, right? So school became a place for me to safely talk to detectives about what was going on, whether it be an observance of my father's behavior, whether it be ultimately when I found the photographs of the house and his mistress in front of the fireplace that was wrapped in plastic, which is ultimately where they dug my mother's body up from underneath that house that he purchased in another state. So there were lots of things that were going on in that particular situation where it had nothing to do with school. It had to do with being safe, if that makes sense. So I had that sort of situation. And then obviously her body is found. My father is arrested. I testify at the grand jury. And then because of that testimony at the grand jury, I am then orphaned by my family. Father's side of the family wants nothing to do with me. You're putting your father in prison. Mother's side of the family says, we want nothing to do with you because you look like your father, which I don't. But that was their way of coping with it. And look, people cope with trauma in all sorts of ways. It doesn't necessarily mean it makes any sense or it's right or it's fair, but the world is not fair, right? Then I had to sort of go through that process. And because of my mother's role in not only the school, but the community, my mother had a lot of friends. And those friends that were my friends were also loved my mother. So then I not only had to deal with my own sort of grief, but I found myself in a position as a kid where I was, essentially, finding myself helping others grieve, right? And so there's a little bit of that common ground in it, in a sense, because there, you know, you end up with yourself trying to process everything. You then end up going through your grief while helping others cope with the same grief, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I think also because you are like very, like as a young child, you were an old soul. That's what I grabbed from you, you know, like hearing your testimony and stuff. So that, you know, if I were to say, okay, well, that without knowing you and just seeing that on interviews and stuff like that, that sounds right, because it's almost like you had this like nurturing side of you anyways. And I think that that was also like not even knowing that you were also that for your mom, right? Because like your mom and you were so close and she wasn't with your father. So, you know, that's actually really interesting that you kind of took on that role after, of just being this like caretaker at such a young age.
Yeah, I mean, it's caretaker essentially of myself, right?
Right.
And I guess, you know,
but looking out for others, you know?
Yeah, well, I think, but that also, I think, is part of I think when you are sort of in a situation where you are grieving something that is so severe, you know, it almost helps to, it helps to have something that distracts you, right? And I did a TED talk about this, where I talked about, like, you know, approaching trauma in a way where you like being either of service or being of action really is what ultimately is what ends up leading you through that trauma, right? So you ultimately have this whole, you're on this journey yourself, right? And then, you know, you sort of bring the other people with you in a way, but at the same time, you're still coping. It's all about you. You're coping with it yourself too, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
How was it about, like, and I want to get to Tara too, like, but you talked about at school you met with detectives and you had to go to the grand jury, you had to testify in court. That means that as a kid that's having to grow up really fast, you're just around a bunch of adults all day that are kind of shuttling you to and from and trying to get information out of you and direct you and all that stuff. How was that? I guess what would be your advice to people who might be in the same situation, maybe not necessarily as children, but having to deal with the mechanics of finding some type of what we call justice, but I don't think really is. But, you know, in this justice system, what's your advice to people that are going through that, dealing with the detectives and the prosecutors and, you know, everybody involved?
Well, it's challenging for certain. But I think for me, I was so laser focused on getting justice for my mother that nothing else really mattered. And I couldn't really sit and think about how bad my life was or what was going on to a certain degree, because at the same, like, then I was like, okay, if I start thinking about that, then it's probably over. Right. Mm. So I think that it was just a very focused, I'm in action sort of thing, you know, moving forward, moving past it. What's next? What now? What am I doing? And leading through that action, right? I think for everyone, it's all, you know, it's all sort of subjective. It depends on what you're doing and where you are in your life. Like you talked about me being carted back and forth with adults, right? So I was, for the most part, just raised, you know, by my mother. So I was constantly treated not only like an adult, but I was around adults in adult situations, which is not necessarily the, you know, the most ideal situation sometimes for people. But for me, it worked because I approached the situation as an adult, as part of sort of this whole, I can't remember what the term is in psychology or child psychology, but essentially it's like being dropped off a cliff onto a mattress, and then how far you spring back on that mattress depends on if you land in like your, you know, your fight or flight, you know, I don't know if that's your cerebral cortex or what, but, you know, or you land more in your limbic system, or you land more in your frontal cortex where you're thinking and you're of action and you're preparing. And I'm not a brain expert, but those systems where you understand what's going on and you're trying to, you're like, I will cope with this once I'm done with this. That's what you have to sort of find. And it's like, that's like, you know, I mean, that's there's the rub, right? You know, like, yeah. how do you really, you know, you just sort of go through it. I mean, we have Tara here, and Tara was attacked by a man who had the intent of killing her, right?
Yeah.
You know, and so you have that, and you have some, so it's like, how do you even, like, when I talk to her, I probably, like, how does that come off? Like, hey, I'm going to do this. I'm going to focus, you know, and survive.
Yeah. Tara, tell us about your experience.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, it was crazy because I kind of got thrown into it of the sense, like, my mom met a psychopath, and then he came and terrorized our family in that sense. And then so I got thrown into it just by my mom. And so that was an interesting thing to get thrown into, your parent who's supposed to be like your protective figure and whatnot. And then I ended up getting attacked by this male. And, you know, my body goes into fight or flight mode, and I have to fight for my life because my body was already preparing for this because I was being stalked. And when you're being stalked, you're already being hunted. you know, and so that person, that predator, is going to go get his prey soon. So me as the prey was already feeling that there's a predator around me. And so my system was already on guard, you know, and my amygdala was hyperactive, you know, the prefrontal cortex of the brain that Collier was talking about. And so it's just crazy that you get thrown into this situation. And then I ended up having to fight my stepdad in the parking lot. He brought the knife. I actually was able to get the knife from him. My dog was with me in the attack. And then I defended myself. And then it was crazy because afterwards, like, you're in shock. And I definitely agree with Collier about, you know, after everything happens, after, like, the... For me, it's so different because I am alive here today, but there are people still grieving in my situation, even though that person was a bad man and that person was the person trying to attack me. And there's still grief, but I still had to appease to these people who were grieving because I was the person that killed him in a sense. And so I didn't want people to be mad at me for what I had to do in that situation. And then, you know, it brings us on this journey where I felt like I had to speak up to take my narrative back. But of course, I had to, like, grieve for a while. And then the LA Times approached me, did this huge story. And then, so I really became an advocate for these victims. And then, you know, leading into doing all these interviews, I met Collier on his podcast, A Murder, or Moving Past Murder. And he has the documentary, Murder in Mansfield. But I met him on his podcast, and then that's how we actually connected because we really aligned with what happened to us and, you know, the ethics of true crime and all that.
I wanted to know that how you guys had, like, connected. So it was an interview that you did, and then you jived.
Yeah, and then I had said to, you know, I was as someone who, again, I set out to make a film about the consequences of violence, the murder of my mother, leading through trauma, focusing on these things, and then ultimately towards my own journey of healing. Right. I never set out to make a true crime film. So when I started doing my podcast last year, 2021, I, you know, was just sort of telling my story, interviewing other people, sometimes weighing in on sort of cases or, you know, from other people's perspective, from, like, my perspective, right? Unique perspective of a true crime survivor, right? But I didn't ever set out to, like, make a true crime podcast. I just threw it in that category because it is true crime, right? But then I started interviewing people like Tara. When I interviewed Tara, I just became so acutely aware of, like, oh, wow, these victims are really exploited for their stories. And what a unique thing it was for me to be able to control my narrative from Jump Street, essentially. You know, my whole journey was I moved to Los Angeles to become a filmmaker, right? Or, you know, and I was like, okay, this is what I'm going to do, and this is how I'm going to tell the story, right? There's not a lot of people that do that. But on the flip side, there are many people who find themselves in these situations. They're victimized, or they are a victim themselves, or they're a survivor or whatever. And then it just takes on a life of its own through now, especially social media, TikTok, things of that nature. But then, you know, the media and the traditional forms of media, not the new media forms, you know, traditional media, Dateline, 2020, Forensic Files, Unsolved Mysteries, whatever, what have you, right? And then it becomes a movie and a TV series on Lifetime and this, that, and the other. And it takes on this life of its own, sort of multi-headed, you know, tetra-headed hydra. And you're just like, whoa, okay. And you realize the level of the exploitation, then you just go, okay, something needs to be, they need to talk about this a little more, you know? And that's how we sort of land on this ethical true crime thing and, you know, with Survivor Squad.
I love it. I think it's so awesome that that's the focus. And, that you truly want to use your platform to raise that and hold people accountable. And Gavin and I both said, you know, like, not that we've been perfect angels in our journey in terms of having, you know, like, true crime content, but that's very much like where our focus is in terms of victims and helping and raising this question, because you can, you know, have the best of intentions as much as you want, but not everybody does. And when you start, like, you know, now that I've stepped back and really looked at, like, what's out there, I mean, it's, yeah, it makes me really angry, actually. Like, I feel like if you've got a platform, why aren't you using it to have these conversations and hold people accountable and yourself accountable, you know, like, to do better and to lift voices like yours up, you know? Or and that's exactly what you guys are doing on your podcast. I mean, you guys are victims yourselves, essentially, but want to raise other people up.
Well, and we're also letting survivors tell their tell their story in their own words,
right,
which is very rare. It's always someone else is telling their narrative. Someone else is doing this. And that's what makes our podcast unique, because not only have we both been through these things, but we also are able to connect with a fellow survivor and go, okay, we've earned our stripes too, and we're going to let you tell it in your own words. And we are able to get certain things out of people that people can also get out of us that we only talk about amongst ourselves. There are certain things that I only tell certain survivors and people that I'm comfortable with and like my sort of like fam that I would never tell an interviewer, or I would never describe it in the way of the sort of detail or even laugh about it in a way, you know? And I think also part of it is too, is it's interesting because these things like these podcasts and these channels and these companies, they make exorbitant amounts of money off of other people's misery. And then, you know, I find myself often, you know, there was a time when I started going viral on TikTok and people were excoriating me saying, oh, you're profiting off your mother's murder. I'm like, well, first of all, like, I'm making no money. You know, a podcast doesn't have any, you know, it's not like the podcast has, you know, advertisers or anything. I'm doing it to spread awareness and raise awareness. But also, like, this happened to me. And if the police handled it as their missing persons case, and I wasn't this mouthy, obnoxious little kid who convinced one detective to listen to him that his mother was actually murdered, my father would have gotten away with it. So I am allowed to speak with absolute authority in this position, and I'm able to tell the story because I'm the survivor and I'm the one that this happened to. And by the way, my father tried to take my life twice. So let's not forget that, you know?
Right. And in the grand scheme of things, I mean, like, when people say that, I mean, it's just, oh yeah, keyboard warriors are another topic, but you know, like,
it's a navigation of parasocial relationships, but yeah, the parasocial, you know, relationships. Yeah.
Right. And to what would you rather, you know, like, oh, I'd rather profit off of my mom's death. No, like, I'd rather have my mom here, but this is the cards that I was dealt, you know? I mean, oh, that just.
One of the cases that was one of my first cases looking into, you know, doing a YouTube channel was a case called Amanda Winkowski. The victim was named Amanda Winkowski. And she was somebody who was obviously murdered, but the system decided that it was better to be an overdose. I mean, she was found upside down, frozen solid, naked in a garbage can outside of the home of a rapist. And they called that an overdose. So I started digging into everything, and I was able to prove to the DA that the toxicology report proves that she did not overdose. The metabolites that you would expect to find in there are absent. Right. So we got a little attention from a giant production company who shall remain nameless. But after a year of working with them to try, Tara, something you were saying before we really started, you know, a year of working with them to try to get that project off the ground. I was at the gym one morning listening to a playlist of the Beatles, and I hear Paul McCartney sing, "You never give me your money, only give me your funny papers." I sat there and I was like, why am I working so hard for this company that is working to make millions of dollars off of this family? And that was the moment that I realized I'm a participant in exactly what I don't want to participate in. Right?
Yeah. I think, you know, going back to what I was saying earlier, that, you know, when you're working in the media, it's all fun, it's exciting, and you don't really get that these people, it's actually like stories, actual traumas that are being exploited, and you don't get it until you're really in that person's shoes. And, you know, I've worked a little bit in media, and, you know, Collier's worked a lot in media before he even told his story, but I was so excited, you know, all these, even we had like Amanda Knox on our podcast. She's going to be in one of the episodes. And I was so excited to see her story and realizing that was me in high school, excited to see this story. And then meeting this person and going through a trauma myself, I'm like, I can't believe I even thought that. I can't believe I was even excited because Hayden Panettiere was playing her. And I was like, oh, Bring It On to, or what, I don't know. But she was in a lot of different movies during that time of my life. And so that made it so exciting to go watch Amanda Knox's story, who, you know, Amanda didn't have anything really to do with that movie. And so it's just crazy that, you know, you see something, you get so excited about it, but you forget that there's a real person attached to it.
Yeah, that's so well said. And that's what I love, that you do that on your podcast, but a lot on your, you know, TikTok too. You definitely like take advantage of that true crime hashtag where you're forcing people to think about those things, you know, like a sound bite of yours was used, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
It went like pretty viral. What was that one, Tara? I didn't even look into it because I didn't even want to give it like traction.
Thank you. Well, thank you for not looking into it and not giving it traction. But it was so, you know, knowing me, and there's been time apart from my story and apart from my trauma, I just wanted to go on TikTok and start to tell my narrative. And it was funny because Collier was like, I got the idea from Collier because he went on and started to tell his story. But I was like, how can I do my story? And I wanted to do it in different sequences. And so I hate to say it like this, but I wasn't even thinking it as like a soundbite that's like going to get clickbait or anything. I was just like, I'm going to go on and start to tell my story. So that just started me by introducing my name and being like, hi, I'm Tara. I killed my stepdad in self-defense. And I wore a Harley Quinn t-shirt. And the Harley Quinn t-shirt said Daddy's Little Monster. And I didn't really think that through. And so just me saying that with that t-shirt, like, I'm not going to lie, like, I laugh a little bit about it. But, like, you have to understand that there's trauma attached to that. There's a real story attached to it. And it can't be joked about. And, like, this person, like, when the, you know, when a client overshares, or like when you meet someone and they just like overshare, you cannot like think about it that way or do a joke about it that way. If you do repost it in the sense like, hey, you need to check out the story, or hey, there's a little bit more to this, you know, something like that. I appreciate those reposts.
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
We try to be very careful now with wardrobe and TikTok.
Yeah. No more Harley Quinn shirts.
No more Harley Quinn shirts. No.
You guys, Collier, just get on Zoom right before you go on. Like, am I good to record now?
How do I look? Yeah.
Yeah. Tie-dye is okay, right? Blue? Okay.
We're ready.
Collier, I had a question for you from something you said earlier. Do you think you got justice for your mom?
Oh, 100%. No question. 100%.
Yeah.
You know, I think that after, you know, I think after getting the justice in the traditional sense of the word, then it was more so getting the recognition and getting the story out there in a way that it gets people talking about, again, consequences of violence, ramifications of violence, you know, that ultimately became the real process, right? The justice sort of thing was, I mean, not that it was easy, because none of it was easy. It was excruciating. But I would say that the longer form, the long play of all this was not, the justice was pretty swift. The it's the making something positive out of it that took that takes the longest, that is the more arduous of all of this, and is really the most intensive, because everything else seems to happen pretty quickly. But I want to go back to your point that you were talking about the case that you were examining, that you had brought up and you had said to the investigators, you know, one of the interesting things is, and this is like this double-edged sword of the scales of Lady Justice, if you will. You have people that demand very swift justice in these cases, or you have people who, like, we've got to find a perpetrator, right? Okay, somebody did this, we got it, and there's this rush. And then, you know, there's the flip side of where then you have to do like proper detective work, proper police work. Or, you know, you have something like a missing persons case and people go, well, the police didn't do anything about it. And it's, yes, that is a fact that the police didn't do anything about it. But why didn't they do anything about it? Oh, I don't know, because there's dozens of these cases that occur every day. So the level of sort of advocacy that a police officer can do, really until a detective gets a case, is something that is a lot more of a complicated process than one would think. It's not like, okay, they've got this, they've got a great lead, they're going to go hunt this down. It's like, there's so, unfortunately, the way the world works is there's so many of these cases. Like, let's just take my mother's disappearance, right? So it's a missing persons case. And unless this one detective believes me that my mother was murdered, it's going to be handled as such. Well, we all know that it wasn't a missing persons case, right? But that is such a common thing. And let's keep it real. Like, it's not a common thing with, like, people like myself. It's a common thing with mostly women.
Marginalized that, you know,
there's
folks,
some sort of domestic, or women, marginalized folks from marginalized communities, you know, impoverished communities. I mean, where domestic violence is far more prevalent, right? Or at least more known to be prevalent, right? You know, so you have these things of, you have these situations where, you know, if I'm not an advocate for, or this annoying little kid, then the right eyes don't get focused on it. But again, these cases will often disappear into the shadows of yet another case. And really the thing that I look at is that isn't a failure of law enforcement. That is a failure of society as a whole, right? Because we have become tolerant of abuse. We have become tolerant of these situations, or we've become immune to them, maybe is the better word, not tolerant, but
like
immune.
Socially acceptable too.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes we'll even blame the victim, right?
Well, sure. Well, that occurs later, but I think initially you get into these situations where you're looking at them through a lens of, you know, well, yeah, of course it's happening again. Of course it's happening again. There's nothing I can do. And I think when you continue to have these conversations and bring this up, this is why, you know, we were discussing with a fellow true crime advocate and podcaster, like, so, you know, I feel like sometimes I overshare my story. And she goes, no, she's like, I share my story every day. And this is why, because you never knew who it's going to impact. And then it's going to be like, and I'm like, that's a great point. You can't really overshare it, because if it reaches the right person at the right time, you might be able to make a real difference, whether that's the difference in taking someone's life, whether that's the difference in someone taking the right steps to find the loved one, or whatever that is, right? You know, and, you know, then again, to your point, you have this situation where, you know, on the flip side, you have people that do the victim shaming, the victim blaming. Oh, well, this person put themselves in these situations. Oh, this person stayed right in the marriage because of this. Oh, this person. And it's like, it's not that simple, you know? And again, when I was mentioning talking to the incarcerated individual today, you know, what I'm fascinated in is like, what led to that, right? Oh, okay. Oh, so you came from a broken home. Oh, your mom was an alcoholic, left you when you were a baby. Oh, okay. Your father was also an alcoholic because of the community that you grew up in. Alcoholism is rampant in that particular community. Okay, so these are things you weren't afforded, these opportunities or a life that's normalcy. And then, of course, you got strung out on drugs and then you committed this murder. And now you've been incarcerated for 35 years. And this all happened before the age of 17. Okay, got it. And I think that when we start to think about these things, and it's not having compassion, it's not only about having compassion or empathy or understanding, but it's not like, oh, you're feeling sorry for them, or you're somehow acknowledging that what they've done is acceptable. It's not that. You know, it's that you need to understand these situations that cause these things in the first place. That's why having these conversations makes us think, like, what are we doing? Like, let's not start at their in prison. Let's start at they're a kid, right?
Yeah, they're where the fracture was starting.
Where the fracture, like, yeah. If we start thinking about that.
Yeah, I love that.
Then yes. We won't have this.
Right, right. That's so powerful. Now, is that, because I want to ask about your guys' workshop. I'm so, like, I that was, like, one thing I said to Tara. I'm like, this is so awesome. So is that kind of also the hope too, is like not just for in advice in terms of toxic dating, but, you know, like figuring out, you know, like having people aware, I guess, of like who you're being with or whatever, and thinking about those things and where they came from also. Like, I want to know more about the workshop.
Well, I wouldn't say it's like toxic dating. It's also like we're also offering a trauma workshop, right? And trauma recovery. And speaking about our personal experiences on those things. I think for people that are interested in the workshops, they are people that come to us that have already seen what we've been doing. And they're like, we want to know more. And, you know, Tara and I have gajillions of people that reach out to us. That's a real number, gajillions. Gajillions of people that reach out to us on social media or via email or whatever, and contact us asking us for advice or, like, what is this? And this is that type of thing. It's that type of situation where people can come to us and have like a one-on-one or in a group setting where we can share sort of the cheat codes, if you will, of like, this is what we've done. And we're not therapists. We're not counselors, we're not mental health professionals. All but we are suggesting is like, this is what we went through. And look, your father didn't murder your mother. You weren't faced with a situation where your stepfather was trying to kill you, who was high on drugs, and you had to defend yourself. We're not looking for people those extreme. I mean, I'm sure there are people, but that's not the normal thing. But people who are also struggling with, maybe they were involved with a narcissist. Maybe they're in a bad relationship. Maybe they had a bad relationship with a parent. Maybe they had this. How did they can glean things from us that they wouldn't get from other people, because our circumstances are so extreme that's what that offers them. I'm going to let Tara weigh in.
I'm going to weigh in because, okay, so this is the fourth time that I've been doing this workshop, but this time I'm adding in Collier to it because he is a male. He's been through this great journey of transformation. He's done the work to get to a great place in his life and has great coping skills, all this stuff. And I've really done a lot of research in my own healing journey. I've done things that work for me, things that haven't worked for me. We're going to share them all. Each week you're going to learn about like different things, but each week there's going to be a live call with us, and then that's when you're going to be able to ask us questions, you know, ask us about our experiences, ask our advice, anything that you want to know, that's the time to ask us. And it's really great because since this isn't my first workshop, I really got to see a lot of these people grow who have been at previous workshops. And a lot of these people are actually rejoining because they want to know Collier's experience from a male, because the only thing really missing from my workshops before was that other male experience. And so that's why it's going to be even better than, you know, if you have done something with me in the past or with Collier, because you get both of us. And I think that is just amazing. Because you don't get to really, you know, you get to deal with your trauma then, and you get two experts in it. And people who have come to me, they have really gone through therapy even, and their therapist isn't helping them. And this is really kind of like the last resort of like, what do I need to do? I've tried everything. And it's really great because you learn about the nervous system, you learn about past relationships, you learn about attachments, you learn about a lot of stuff that you didn't know about in the past, you learn about red flags, and, you know, it's just given tools and experts to help you guide through that process.
Yeah.
I love that. I do a series on my channel where I allow viewers to, or not allow, they write into me and then I read all of their emails on those episodes so that they can feel like they have a platform where they're being heard. So, you know, like I know that a lot of my supporters are going to be very interested in this. So there's no, you know, they don't have to have a similar story to you, like Collier was saying, you know, like that was the max, right? So like anybody who's feeling like they just need to be heard and supported and maybe just, like you said, sometimes listen, I've been through a lot of therapy in my life, and my favorite type of therapy is friend therapy. You know, that you never really get that same, like, I don't know, resolve as you do when you talk to somebody who's been through a very similar situation, or like you said, you know, the extreme, and you're able to relate as opposed to sitting on a couch being, I don't know, nitpicked apart. And this is what you should do instead, Sherilyn. And
well, I mean, that's also why Alcoholics Anonymous exists, right? Which is like the largest, most successful 12-step program in the history of the world, right?
Right.
You know, because the alcoholics are like, nobody else is going to understand what I'm going through unless you're an alcoholic.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And, you know, it's the same thing. It's not, it's, you know, your situation might not be the same or as extreme, but you find solace in knowing like, oh, okay, if that person, I mean, that's the biggest thing for me is that when people hear my story or this, the film or whatever, they listen to me, and I'm sure Tara would concur with this 100%, but they're like, look, if you can go through what you went through, I can sure as hell deal with my daddy issues or my, you know, my shit, you know, whatever that is. Right. And I think that that's sort of, you know, that's the thing, right? It's like, oh, okay, we're all human having a human experience, but we want to really touch that with others.
Yeah. And trauma's trauma.
And trauma's trauma.
Yeah, I love that actually, because that took me a long time to learn too, because I feel like it, you know, like my trauma compared to somebody else's, I'm like, oh, well, that wasn't even comparable, you know, and it's, everybody is different, right? That took me a long time to learn that. So I like that you just said that. So the workshop, is it one-on-one? Is it multiple people style? Like, how does that work if somebody wants to register?
So if you want to register, we both have links in our bio, I think, on Instagram. Also on my website, you could go straight to my website, Tara Newell Survival, and sign up there. There is two workshops. One is No More Toxic Dating, and the other is Moving Past Trauma. And they're both 5 weeks. Each week, there will be a live call, an hour live call with us. And you'll get to interact even with other people. You get to ask us questions. But each week there is homework. There is, and you don't have to like complete the homework. It's not like you're going to get in trouble, you know. But there is homework, you know, if you want to actually do the work. Right. And I think it's so important to, and I have like a book, like lots of books recommended. So like this is 5 weeks where, you know, and I recommend everybody to kind of tell their friends like, hey, I'm going to be doing this workshop. I'm going to be in my healing journey. I don't really want to go out drinking and stuff. I want to, you know, don't date during that time really, because you're going to be raw and you're going to be vulnerable. And if you're dating, you're going to be acceptable to those toxic people because you're in that emotional state.
Wow. Yeah, that's a really, really good point. I never even considered that. Okay, so these are great tips. I'm going to put the link too. I'll go and find those so that we can have it on this
I'll make sure episode. Tara emails you for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. I have a question about just something that both of you brought up. I'd love to hear your response first, Tara, and then call you. But at some point after this trauma happened for both of you, right? And like, forgive me, but Tara, I think like it, forgive me for maybe characterizing this incorrectly, but that trauma of having to defend yourself happened in a moment, right? It was momentary and it was almost animalistic, right? But at some point you were probably interviewed by police and you had to tell them what happened, right? And the reason that I'm thinking about this is because, Collier, you brought up the detective, the one detective who believed you that this was not a missing persons, this was a murder case, right? So I'm curious to hear both of you maybe express to us maybe the qualities of the people that you spoke to who are the most helpful in the, I guess, in the law enforcement side of things, right? The detectives, the investigators, maybe the trauma, you know, counselors or whatever. Who were the people, as you were going through this journey within the system, who were those people that helped the most, and how was it that they were most helpful?
For me, it was really interesting because we tried to get the police involved at first. We tried to get restraining orders and we weren't able to. We were told we were crazy. Oh, it sounds like you're just like, you know, in an argument with someone. And we were really brushed aside. And even when John lit my mom's car on fire, my high school officer actually got that case and he went on a couple of vacations, and I even saw him afterwards and he felt very badly about everything. And I didn't understand until I talked to my mom and talked to her that, like, she would call him all the time and tell him that she was in fear for her life. So in that case, like, I feel that, and I actually wrote an article. I don't think it's out there anymore because something happened with my past website. But I wrote an article about Unbelievable, that series, and the difference between the cops who were interrogating these victims. And there was such a difference. There was a male white cop who was harsh. He didn't really believe the person. He kind of brushed, like, what she was saying aside. She was emotional, so he didn't take her serious. Seriously, there was another case where this woman cop went to this girl. She pulled her aside. She was like, hey, I want to bring you to a safe area so we can talk safely. I want to know, like, let you know you're safe now. You know, what do you need from me before we start asking questions? She was sensitive about the questions. She was carefully asking the questions. She was nurturing to her in the sense with boundaries. And I thought that it was great how she handled it opposed to this other person who was abrupt. He was kind of like, oh, I don't believe her. And you really get the energy and you really have to come at these victims with calm energy. And like, okay, I believe you. Like, what happened? Tell me what happened. You know, from your own words, I'm here for you. Because what these people really need is a safe figure after something completely traumatized their lives and wrecked their lives in this sense.
In any point during, like, your statements and stuff, Tara, did you ever have somebody who was, like, aggressive?
I had a lot of males around me. They were asking me questions abruptly. They told me even that my mom went to go be with her husband when really they asked her to go identify him. And so they were not kind to me. They were rude to me. They didn't handle the situation well. I did not feel safe. However, I did have my dog there. And that made me feel somewhat comforted, where I was able to answer these questions to them. And I knew that I wasn't going to be in trouble. I just had that feeling because I didn't bring the knife there. I tried to run away from him. I did everything I could to avoid that situation. I just had to do what I would. Did because if he's on top of me, he's gonna get the knife. I have right. to take the knife. I have to do what I did.
Right, 100%. So it was easier for you to at least be like, you know, when the evidence is stacked up, I know that I did everything okay, regardless yeah. of how you're coming at me.
I think when you're innocent, you just speak with conviction.
100%. The truth is the easiest thing to remember.
Yeah.
Right, right.
That's the thing. If people ask me about my testimony, they'll be like, oh yeah, you're so good on the witness stand. You know, obviously you were coached. And I'm like, the reason why it's so pure, it flows is because the truth is the easiest thing to remember. And when you're telling the truth, it is so pure, it flows. And you know, I said, you know, I was on the witness stand for 2 days as a 12-year-old kid. To think that I could somehow remember some rehearsed script is utterly fanciful. I mean, most adults couldn't remember something and testify for 15 minutes in a courtroom in such a high pressure situation, let alone a child. So yeah, it's ridiculous, but you know, you have that.
So Collier, that detective that believed you, what was it about him that made him that way, or her? I don't know.
Him, you know, no, Dave Messmore. I mean, he just, I think that it was just the perfect storm of the fact that when, you know, I pulled him aside and I said, give me your card. And then I think it was like the conviction that I had, like that is ultimately what made him go, okay, this kid really believes this. And I had the evidence to back it up. That's the thing too, is that I had, you know, I had all the stories about my father's proclivity for violence, the way that he was violent towards me and my mother, the mistress, the whole thing. And that ultimately is what, you know, let him, because he went out on a limb, right? He didn't, you know, it wasn't like, you know, like my father was a doctor in a small town in rural, not rural, but in Ohio, a Midwestern town.
Small
like
town,
You know, you don't just go after the doctor, you know what I mean, without like some sort of overwhelming avalanche of evidence. And so even his captain was like, we're not going after this guy. You're out of your mind. He's going to sue us. And Dave was like, you know, but this kid, I think he was convinced that I was going to haunt his dreams if he didn't do it. but yeah, this is also sadly the ramifications of being the last child in your friend group that gets a Nintendo. So, you know, your imagination is running wild.
Oh my gosh.
I was hoping that would land. Maybe there was a delay. I was like, is that joke going to land?
So don't get your kids a Nintendo, guys.
You want to stay safe.
Oh my gosh. Thank you guys so much. I honestly, like I said, I mean, Tara, now when you were like, oh, I was excited to talk to him, and I was like, okay, well, I was excited to talk to you guys just to as individuals, not to talk in, you know, about what happened and that there's all the movies and the documentaries, but just like what you guys have been able to do for survivors. And
thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. And our podcast comes out first quarter next year, probably January. And, okay. You know, you guys can find us on all the socials. I have, at Collier Landry, we have at Survivor Squad. Tara has hers.
At Tara Newell.
My podcast is called Moving Past Murder. The new one with Tara is called Survivor Squad. So we're looking forward to sharing those stories with the world. We've got a lot of great interviews lined up.
Yeah, that's amazing. So we'll have them. You guys will have to definitely keep me posted. I'm going to have everything linked in this episode anyways. But when you guys are live and ready, I'll give everybody a quick reminder.
Yeah, and support our Patreon as we get live and ready. Yes, we have a Patreon. Okay.
Perfect.
Awesome. Thanks,
there's
guys.
Like lots of behind the scenes stuff on there.
Yeah, there is. It's great stuff.
See, I love that. I that's the only reason why I think I would want to do the Patreon route is to get all that behind the scenes stuff.
Yes.
Right. Okay, everybody smile. Everybody smile for the Patreon.
Thank you guys so much.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.